Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM and In Person with Paul. I'm Paul Burke and I write about crime fiction. And of course here I interview authors about their latest novels. Now my guest today is Louise Candlish, and her latest thriller, The Only Suspect, is just out in hardback. And it's got all the things that readers flock to her writing for: reveals and twists, gripping plot, and absorbing characters. As ever, this is a wide-ranging chat. We cover Candlish's career, her stellar hits, and some really exciting TV developments. So let's hear what Louise Candlish has to say about The Only Suspect. Hello and welcome to Crime Time FM, Louise.
Hi there.
Nice to have you with us. So obviously we're going to be talking about your new novel, The Only Suspect, which is out, I think, on the 2nd of February. Just for you know, this broadcast will go out on the 3rd.
Oh, okay, brilliant.
And I was thinking about going back a little bit, though, and thinking about your early influences. I mean, when did you take up reading seriously, you know, and what was it that got you into it?
Well, I mean, I grew up in the 70s and, you know, we didn't have a lot of entertainment. So younger listeners won't be able to comprehend a world pre-digital.
The idea of three television channels for a start.
No, absolutely. I mean, TV was very central to life, but, you know, it wasn't on 24 hours a day. And there was probably an hour a day of programming that was interesting to a child. So I was reading then. I've got an older sister, 18 months older, and so I tended to sort of read whatever she had read first. Right. And so it was very much the Enid Blyton era. My dad was actually a teacher at that time. And so, and interestingly, I've since discovered that so many authors have at least one parent who was a teacher at some point. Yeah. And I think so, you know, there were just always books. We were always going to secondhand bookshops. We didn't have very much money at all, but we were enthusiastic library goers. And so I just always had a book on the go. And I think the first time I kind of understood that I was really getting pleasure from a read was a Famous Five book, I think, you know, because they were just perfectly pitched mysteries. So yes, I guess the first book that really got me going was a junior mystery. And then I read all of the Secret Sevens and, you know, the Five Find Outers and Dogs, and, you know, basically everything before moving on to Agatha Christie.
Right.
And I tended to be someone who read the whole lot. I was a binger before, box set binge viewing, was a thing. I was a binge reader. So, you know, I wouldn't just read one by an author. I would go and borrow every single book in the library by them and just get through their complete works. Although I didn't feel that when I was studying Shakespeare. I didn't feel the need to read the whole lot then. But
And to be fair, one or two of them, like Henry VIII, are bloody hard going, to be honest.
No, I haven't even attempted. I haven't even attempted. I do love Shakespeare, and I really like going to the Globe. I actually prefer Shakespeare performed. You know, funnily enough, I prefer drama performed to reading it and studying it. So I was a reader from a very young age, and that was just a habit. I really used it a bit like music. I used it to escape, and I really enjoyed creating the visuals that went with the story. And, you know, I think that's what is special about reading, you know, whether it's Kindle, print or audiobook, you are creating the imagery and rather than it being done for you. Yeah.
I think that's very true. One of the clever things writers do is to make a suggestion of a character. You don't actually pin it down, you know, tell people what they look like exactly and what they wear, because you want the reader to be so involved in it. And the earlier you can get them to do that, the better.
That's so true. Yeah.
Thinking about Agatha Christie as a way in, you know, I tend to find there's two routes. People either say that they go Agatha Christie in the Golden Age, you know, and it's that, or it's the hard boiled and it's that way. And often, obviously, Sherlock Holmes comes into it.
Yeah.
What do you think of these modern interpretations of the Agatha Christie stories? You know, the Kenneth Branagh films and the one with John Malkovich, for instance.
I don't know if I've seen the one with John Malkovich. Right. I've seen the Kenneth Branaghs. I think they're kind of, you know, they're not for me, because right. I saw the originals and, you know, that in my formative years. And so, you know, you're never going to beat that, that 70s Murder on the Orient Express, as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, obviously gathering, you know, sort of today's stars and making that, you know, making it hyper glamorous, which is what Kenneth Branagh has done. You know, I can see the appeal. If I was in my 20s, I would love that. But for me, they just feel like they've lost something of the menace that those older versions had, where a lot of it, again, was in the viewer's mind, you know, trying to, you know, to figure out what those dark looks meant. Whereas it's all, it's a lot more kind of there for you on a plate with the new versions. In terms of the literary sort of reinterpretations, so people Ruth Ware and Lucy Foley, I love them, and I love that actually, you know, they are inspired by Agatha Christie and other Golden Age detective stories. But you almost don't need to know that. They work on two levels. You could simply discover one of those authors and love those books. Or you could be looking to see which might be the original book that inspired it. And I'm no different, really. I mean, I do it with all kinds of writers. I'll be inspired by a book. So The Only Suspect was loosely inspired by a Barbara Vine. We're all big readers, and we're all inspired by something. And you know, that's what it's all about. It's putting modern twists on classic stories, because it's very, very hard to create a new type of story. It's always going to be a reimagining.
It's much more about, it's in the way you tell it.
Yes.
And whether you can make it interesting for people in a new way. But yes, of course, the essences are there. They're all there, the old stories. You know, as they say, there's only sort of seven archetypes, isn't there? So
yes, absolutely. And I've probably only ever dealt with a couple of them. But yes, it's true. And also you can kind of mash up stuff. So the Only Suspect, I feel like, you know, it's probably one of the clearest in terms of what my inspirations are. So you'll find the Barbara Vine inspiration, but also there's a very obvious Hitchcock influence in there. We won't say which movie, because it will give the game away.
So
I like drawing on all kinds of inspirations and influences, and music as well sometimes. And I don't see any rules. I just do what I want. And, you know, I will steal something from somewhere and somewhere else, and then I'll put my own characters with their, you know, sort of very distinctive banter with lots of swearing, and then, you know, suddenly you are creating something new, but all of the elements have, you know, exist already out there. Of course they do.
Yeah of course. But we'll dig into that a little bit, actually. Just one question before we do. Well, let's go again sort of to the origins, but when you started writing, what was the actual spur for that?
I think it was boredom. Because I was traveling. I had taken a career break in my early 30s, and I was in Sicily backpacking, on a kind of $5 a day budget type thing.
Right.
And hadn't really given it that much thought. I just thought, I need to get away from London. I need to, you know, I've worked since, you know, the day I turned 21 full time, and I'd never had any travel time off, really.
Yeah, right.
And so I went on this trip, and my boyfriend was with me for the first 2 weeks, and then he flew back and I was on my own, and I was going to be staying for another 6 weeks. Within moments, I was really bored, and I just wasn't used to not working, and I needed a project. And I just started to have this idea about a story of a girl who was stalking an ex on holiday. And I reached the Sicilian island of Panarea, and I just found it so inspiring. I thought, I'm going to stay here for a bit longer than planned, and I'm going to set this story here. And I didn't really know what it was going to be, whether it would be a short story or a novel. And I hadn't, you know, I'd written stories as a child, but I hadn't written anything in as an adult. And I just got so into it, and it was just so enjoyable figuring it out. And I wrote it in longhand in a notebook. I mean, I didn't even have a laptop with me. This was 2001.
Do you use a laptop now?
Yeah, I use a laptop now. This was the early part of the century. I probably had a couple of paperbacks with me and a notebook and pen, and I didn't have any, devices at all. Actually, do you know what? Maybe I had a, what were they called? Like Walkmans that were disc.
Oh, Yeah,
the had CDs. I had one of those. And so I came back and I typed it up on a PC and then I thought, actually, you know, this is a full-length novel. It's quite, you know, I think it's quite feels quite short. And it wasn't hugely ambitious. It was, you know, obviously literally a first attempt. And then that book ended up being published and it was called Prickly Heat. And just this year has been reissued with a new title, The Island Hideaway. And I'm still really fond of it. I mean, when if someone read Our House or The Only Suspect or The Other Passenger, and then they read The Island Hideaway, they would be astonished because, you know, it's probably got about a 20th of the complexity or psychological insight. But it was a really fun romp. And also, I think, sort of did foreshadow some of the themes that I later, you know, really ran with.
And
stalking is no fun. I mean, you know, I wrote it as a sort of a comedy, but actually she was doing something illegal and unpleasant in that book.
And something that unfortunately is just something that we know a lot more about it now, but it's there constantly and it's not really dealt with.
No, and I think people tend to see crimes, you know, at their most dangerous and menacing when it's male on female. And this was a female character who was a little bit of a Bridget Jones type, was stalking someone who could, you know, look after himself. He was never really in any physical danger. But even so, I think the beginnings of my interest in subversive behavior were on display in that early work. And in fact, there were quite a few of those early books where within relationships, women were doing quite peculiar things.
Yeah, there are certainly some very subversive characters in the new novel. So let's look at a couple of questions around the writing over the course of your career. I think is it 16 novels?
Yeah, 16 novels. And then I've also written a novella for Quick Reads, which was also a psychological thriller. Yeah.
Right. And so there are recurring themes, as you've just talked about. And you like to change structure and innovate in the way you write. I'm just wondering, though, do you think you've got a signature style now? Do you think there's an identifiable? Do you think about that even, or is it just you approach every book?
I do feel like I'm innovating, and you know, for myself, I'm not entirely sure how that fits into the context of my contemporaries, but I am for myself trying to do something new each time and reinvent the wheel. But having said that, of late, I have noticed more in terms of the feedback I get from readers and the way people interpret my stories that there is a signature style, and it's very much that you'll get a slow burn setting up at the, you know, maybe the first third or even the first half. So you really, you know, I'm asking people to stick with it before anything big happens, which I think is, you know, quite a lot to ask, given, you know, how fractured our concentration is these days. But I seem to be doing that. I seem to need a relatively long time to set things up. And to you know, sort of get inside the heads of my characters and to
fairness,
do all
that goes
of
with the
misdirection.
Complexity.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then an enormous amount will happen there on in. So you know, the books are more exciting in the latter stages than they are perhaps at the beginning. But that has happened completely naturally. I've never been taught how to write, and I've never ever attended even a, you know, a day course in structuring or novel writing. And so that has just built up instinctively. And I think it's okay. I mean, it's probably not textbook way, particularly in terms of thrillers, but I don't really think of my books as thrillers. I think of them as thrilling dramas, and I don't think of them as having that, you know, kind of cliffhanger at the end of every chapter. I'm not going for a cliffhanger at the end of every chapter. I'm not looking for new jeopardy every, you know, 1,000 words or whatever the, you know, you do in a classic, you know, sort of Lee Child, Harlan Coben style American thriller. I'm not doing that at all.
What you're saying is the kind of reader you want is somebody who's prepared to take that time and realize that you get a better story that way. I mean, the thing about doing it with the cliffhanger thing is it's an instant hit, but it's not as gratifying really as a read. Do you think over the years, then you can tell the differences in style of your writing? I mean, obviously, anybody could say, you know, after 16 novels, it must be more polished, you know, and you mentioned how the first novel is less complicated, shall we say. But are there other things you notice about your writing now that did you feel has changed over the years?
Well, I would say that the plotting is more complicated and polished, but I would say the phrase making, if anything, is not as polished.
Right.
Sometimes when I read some of my older books, I think, oh my God, that's almost poetry. I obviously really thought about the phrasing a lot more. Whereas now I spend a lot more time trying to think of original plots and trying to weave things together. And so the polishing of the phrasing, you know, the sort of, there's less lyricism, I think. And, you know, I think that's okay. I think they're still relatively elegantly written. Mm-hmm. But when I look back at some of, you know, say my fourth, fifth, sixth books, they mm-hmm. were family dramas. You know, I thought every thought was really, you know, sort of, thoroughly sort of enunciated, and so I think it felt a bit more elegant in those days, but I don't think that too much has been sacrificed, because I think there's also a certain reward in things being a bit more concise. I'm definitely more concise. I'm definitely less descriptive. I think that's something that you learn with a long career, that you in the beginning, you delight in those, you know, sort of passages where you're describing a beach or you're describing, you know, a city scene. And, you know, you think you're Dickens. but then as you go on with your career, you find ways to get that passage into a single sentence, and you can convey exactly what you would have conveyed 20 years earlier, but you can just do it more efficiently. And so I think that's really good. And then that frees up more space for other things as well.
I think that's brilliant, because you know what? Sometimes I ask authors that question and I think it stumps them completely. They're not really sure about those kinds of things. And I think it's there, you know, but does it get easier? Is it sort of different or harder?
I think it gets hard when you become known for twists and original plots. It is hard. It's hard to sustain the quality. And that's always been my driving force, which is, you know, I really want every book to be of equal quality to the one that came before, if not better.
Of course, yes.
And so I do find it quite hard and a bit scary if I haven't got, you know, in the period before the idea arrives. I'll wonder if I can do it again, because you know, I've done it quite a few times now,
and you should be able to say, hey, okay, but
yeah, and especially if you signed a contract for another couple of books and you're like, okay, right, I've definitely got to do this two more times. So it also gets easier in terms of your confidence in yourself. So you kind of, you know you'll pull it out of the bag, because you always have. And so there's no such, for me, there's not really any such thing as writer's block, because I have the confidence of experience. So it's both harder and easier, I think. But also there's a sense now that, I mean, I'm in my early 50s, so it's not like I'm about to retire, but I do have that feeling that, you know, I don't want to waste any books. I want each book to be one that I'm really proud of and to say something. I think I've started to say something, not in a kind of, you know, political lecturing sort of way, but the social commentary element is something I'm really interested in, and I want each book to have a theme in that respect, and they tend to be cautionary tales, and you know, so I like to think of contributing something that's more than just pure entertainment. I mean, it's probably 95% entertainment, but I'd like there to be the 5% where I'm saying something about the way we live and, you know, British society. Mm-hmm. Hopefully in a way that doesn't necessarily, you know, give away my own views. I mean, it all comes through characters, and I tend to give, you know, both sides of an issue without really coming down heavily on either.
Yeah, more about asking a question than actually trying to answer it.
Yeah, absolutely. Just saying, you know, is it, you know, for instance, with my property books, you know, really just asking us to think about how much time we're spending thinking about property, you know, to allow the media to whip us into a frenzy about house prices and getting on the property ladder. And, you know, when you think that you do only live once, do we really want to have spent this much time trawling Rightmove?
Absolutely,
and, you know, perhaps neglecting friendships and even family in pursuit of, you know, creating the perfect house. I mean, that's where, you know, I'm guilty of it myself. I'm not saying I'm to you, and you should let me tell you how to live your life. It's more like, you know, what are we doing collectively with this obsession? Will we live to regret it, you know, later?
I understand what you mean, because we can get carried away with things. I mean, actually, I suppose one of the worst things in life is actually never taking a moment to think, you know what, things are quite good. And there are these things in my life, you know, but when something's bad, you're constantly thinking about it. It's always on your mind. There's always a problem. But you never actually just stand back and think, yeah, actually, this is really good.
Yeah, no, that's so true. We should. I think the problem is, you know, this is what I tackle in The Other Passenger, which, you know, has a line at the beginning. The dedication is for anyone who's tempted to compare up. And I think that we're just, if you can challenge that instinct in yourself to compare up, or even to compare at all with anyone other than yourself, and what you've achieved in the past, then if you can triumph over that instinct, then I think you can live a more contented life. And I think I have just about managed to do that.
Right.
I mean, it is hard in careers where it's, you know, you're literally judged on your sales figure. So it's a bit like sport. It really is. You know, you've got a chart, you've got positions, someone's number one, someone's number two, someone's number 15,000. So it's quite hard to get over. Yeah. It's quite hard to get over that, because it's, you know, it's rammed down your throat at all times. Your value is based entirely on your past achievements. But I think if you can just always work within the context of what you've done before and what you've achieved before, then I think that's a healthier way to you can then get rid of the anxiety and any bitterness or any envy, and you can just say, okay, yes, their debut book is a masterpiece and it sold 2 million copies. I was never going to be that good at that age, at that time, but actually my current book is better than my last book, and so I'm doing okay.
Yeah, I soon learned that this isn't all about art. It's an awful lot about money and everything else. But talking about good times, I mean, there has been a lot of good points. The Richard and Judy, Sunday Times bestseller, TV, you know, very successful books and loved by readers. And of course, one of the things about that is it's instant fame, isn't it? It's, you know, after 15 years of working really hard at it, suddenly everybody knows who you are. And what's that like?
I think it's really funny because, you know, it really makes me laugh that lots of people think that Our House was my first book.
Right.
when, you know, I've literally been around. My first book was published in 2004, and then Our House came out in 2018. So 14 years. Yeah. So it'd be almost, almost exactly as you judged, 15 years of overnight success. I think you just really have to, you know, appreciate success and any kind of acclaim and sales figures and all of it. When you get it, you definitely can't be, you know, kind of Yabu sucks in your attitude. That's just, you know, silly and wastes time. But equally, you can't feel like, well, now that I've got it, I'll have it forever. There's no entitlement. So I just try and take every bit of news on its own merits. Right. And I always say to people who ask, you know, who do say, oh, what's it like to, you know, have your book on TV? And I'm sounding like David Brent now. I can hear David Brent in the way I'm speaking. I do say, actually, this week, if you had a look at my emails, you'll see there are 5 rejection emails. You know, for every bit of good news that, you know, your book has got a translation deal in China or whatever.
Right, right.
Or you've just got a, you know, a new Norwegian deal, or a book's been optioned for the screen. For every one of those bits of news, there will be multiple emails telling you you've been rejected for something else. And I've got a lot of projects on the go now. I'm doing quite a few TV projects. And so has multiplied the potential for rejection. So believe me, it's still a roller coaster.
So it always helps you keep your feet on the ground. Yeah.
It's just part of the game. It's just part of the game. And, you know, and again, the sports analogy, I know it's a bit sort of cliched, but, you know, even Djokovic doesn't win every time. You know,
that's where resilience
being
comes
in it
isn't
is
it?
The pleasure. Being in it and being competing is the fun thing. But you've got to be a gracious loser, and sometimes you've got to say, yes, that, you know, that person has written a better book. They deserve that.
Yeah. It's a bit about resilience and the actual bounce back, isn't it? You're going to get those knocks. It's the ones who stand up again and come back again are the ones who make a success out of it.
Really. Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, I always say that, you know, much as it is lovely to have, you know, that massive smash hit with your first book, it can be quite dangerous psychologically because, you know, the only way is down in a way. Whereas when you start with a flop, as I did, and, you know, and then had mostly, you know, books that didn't, you know, worry any chart around the world, you do get that feeling that, you know, things can only improve. And that's quite a nice feeling. I've always liked the feeling of thinking, well, you know, anything could happen. But I think if everything happens right at the beginning, I think it can be quite hard then to deal with a second or third book.
I'm sure you know novelists. Yeah. I certainly know a few who struggled after that first one. Really struggled because it was such a success in the first place.
Yeah. Well, this is it. I think that especially when you start out, you have no idea how publishing works. And so you genuinely believe that that success is because the book was exceptional. But I think when you've been published for, you know, for the number of years that I have, you realize that the vast majority of success comes from brilliant publishing because there are so many brilliant books,
right?
You know, of equal merit and equal quality and equal originality. And the difference is how well it's published.
Yes.
But you don't really think that if it's your, you know, if it's your first book, you think, well, mine must have been special. And sometimes, you know, they are special, absolutely. But sometimes they've just had the most magnificent publishing and, you know, had that lucky break with a,
yeah,
you know, Reese Witherspoon pick or a Richton Judy pick. And then you're on your way and you, you know, you just don't realize how magical those elements are. But you know, when you're an old timer like me, you know what it's all about, and you know it's about the budget, and you know
you've
it's about
you know
it's about the push and the muscle. And then of course, you know, publishers can only do so much. They can get the books on the shelves, they can get the press, they can get the hype and the buzz going, but what they can't do is guarantee that you'll hit the zeitgeist. And that
so in that sense, do you still think that word of mouth is important?
Yeah, really important.
I mean, like, for instance, with Our House, I'm sure that what a lot of people probably said was, you know, oh, this book is great. And the ending, wow, you know.
Yeah. I think that did have a lot of word of mouth. I mean, it had and that's a really good example. And The Other Passenger also. Really good publishing. My publishers just got it into a lot of hands, loads of press, great slots with the retailers. But at that point, word of mouth took off as well. And then things go to the next level. And that's very hard to predict. But that's what's exciting about, you know, the creative arts. I think you don't really know what's going to take off.
It's exciting to
see. Yeah.
You know, you can get a lot of novels that come along on the back of success of one particular type of novel, and then there's another 7 and 8 and 9, and they come along with the same sort of theme.
Yeah. Oh god, yeah. Publishing loves to chase the trend.
Oh yeah. But thinking more about your writing now, again, and what we were talking about then, I mentioned the end of the book, and of course you mentioned earlier about the twists. And you also said about how long, you know, when you do a slow burn, you have to get people with you. And this is as crucial, I think, in your writing as anything, is that hook. That's what you do at the start. Now, every book, in a sense, is going to have some kind of hook. So if there's a murder, then you've got something to find out about. But I think it's more the way you do it. It's you really put questions in people's heads at the start. It happens with The Heights. It happens with this book. It happened with Our House. You know, you give them such a big idea to think about. So really that hook is how you can then sustain this idea of a long period of people having building up the story and finding out little bits as you go along. I mean, is that fair?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think one of the ways that I've learned you can do that best is with the the dual timeline. And you'll start The Heights and Our House, absolutely. You start with the terrible discovery in the present day, and then you immediately go back into the past and you see how this situation developed into this, you know, very mysterious crisis. I think I have definitely, sort of taken the ball and run with the dual timeline, and I've done it as well, you know, probably with bells on, in The Only Suspect, because there's 25 years between past and present in the new one. But yeah, I think that
and we
that,
don't quite know what's going on, and that's sort of even more of a hook. We know something's wrong.
I think it takes a lot of honing. It takes a lot of polishing when you do that, because you know, you might have the first version, you might give too much away, or you might not give enough away, so it's not intriguing enough. And it takes multiple drafts to get the balance right, I think, and to have enough red herrings and to have enough misdirection, but not too much.
Yes,
because readers are so experienced and clever with these devices, and you know, things are guessable if you don't get the balance exactly right. So it just takes a lot of layering and a lot of time to get that effortless sense of asking intriguing questions and then moving you away to something else.
Yeah.
I never get it right first time. And with my two strands, even right until the final draft, there'll be quite a lot of repositioning of chapters for maximum sort of effect.
Right.
You know, the way which chapter in the present day will lead into what event in the past.
How you order them really does make a big difference to how the story unfolds and that for the reader. It's an inevitable question, because I have to talk about the twist or the reveal, both in your novels. There's an awful lot of deception in your novels. There's perhaps even more deception than usual in this novel. And it makes it difficult to talk about the plot, actually.
Yeah, it's almost impossible.
Yeah, I'm not afraid of actually giving a spoiler away, but I am afraid of pointing people in a direction that gets them somewhere quicker than they should get there, because they should read the story. So that makes it slightly difficult. But anyway, back to this thing about the twists and reveals. I mean, they've kind of become crucial in your novels, haven't they? Do you feel that?
They have, yeah. I mean, I have talked with my publishers about maybe toning down the marketing sort of lines of queen of twists, and you know, because it's you do risk the reader sort of reading without that natural innocence, you know, just sort of looking for the twist, waiting for the twist, thinking, well, you know, is this twist, is her big twist going to be to do with this? Whereas if you just read a book cold without knowing there's a twist, I think the twist could be a physical shock. It could be incredibly startling.
I see what you're saying.
So I think you do lose that when you're known for your twists. I think that you end up being judged on the twists. So I've slightly got around that by, I mean, I don't really think of them, most of them, as twists anyway. I think of them as just surprises or reveals. But occasionally there will be a big twist, and there is what I would consider a twist in The Only Suspect. I try and have enough surprises and shocks along the way that it's possible that you've already had the big one. That's the way I get around that. It's very unlikely now that there will just be one surprise. There needs to be several. But I love that. I love those sorts of stories. I mean, I love deceptions and betrayals, and I'm really inspired by you know, noir and noir movies and Hitchcock and books with twists. And so for me, it's, you know, that's part of what my job is, to think of surprises and to think. And sometimes that comes from the way the story is told, you know, the sort of narrative devices. And sometimes it comes from the action itself.
Yeah.
Sometimes it comes from a character revealing themselves to have a secret or a part of their identity that they were, you know, weren't letting on about earlier. Yes. There are lots of ways of
unreliable
doing it.
Yeah.
Unreliable narrators. Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. And in one of my earlier books that's not very well known, but I think it's one of my best, The Disappearance of Emily Marr, there's actually a psychological disorder at work, which means that one of the characters doesn't really know who they are. And so, you know, that takes it to another level. But yeah, I'm always looking for new ways to create surprises.
Yeah. The thing then is, when they come along, there's a logic to it. You know, this is where you're talking about readers being clever. I think they are. If you get to the end and it's not logical, or it's a cheat, you feel disappointed. And then the point is, you make it very logical. But is there a sort of a pressure there as well, you know, to keep coming up with new ideas in books and new sort of twists and that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the pressure is part of what the job is, because I know that's the expectation both from my publishers and from readers. Mm. And I want to deliver what's expected of me. But I also do feel like, you know, I do feel confident enough to just do something different if I want to. If the quality of the read is still there, then I wouldn't have any qualms about delivering a non-twisty book. If it was an intense, you know, entertaining experience, right, in a different way. But right now I am still deep in my sort of dual timeline, mm-hmm, device, which I haven't had enough of yet.
Right.
I quite often will think at the beginning of a project, I'm gonna do this in a linear way. There's gonna be no crazy prologue, and there's gonna be no sort of sudden pulling the rug from under the reader's feet. There's going to be none of that. I'm just going to tell a story as if this was the 1930s. But then I always want to complicate it, and I always think of a way to, you know, to put in that surprise. And obviously I love them myself. Otherwise I wouldn't be so drawn to them.
Right. Yes, of course. So tell us about The Only Suspect. How would you describe it?
I would describe it as a slow burn psychological thriller with lots of sort of noir elements. And as I was saying a little bit earlier, what's different about it is that one of the strands is what probably is deemed historical now, because it's 1995.
No,
I think of
that.
It as only yesterday, but a lot of readers won't remember the 90s or would have been younger than me during the 90s. I was in my 20s and having the time of my life. So yeah, one of the strands is in 1995 and one is in the year 2000. And the reason for that, I mean, for a long time I'd wanted to write about the 90s, because that was my heyday and I absolutely loved it. And I just like something on paper that kind of reminded me of, you know, the best years of my life.
Right.
But actually, for this book, I had to have a period before mobile phones, before the digital revolution.
Yes.
The plot, which we obviously can't give away, but it involves a deception that would absolutely not be possible now. As soon as you looked up a couple of questions on Google,
yes,
or on Facebook, you would, you know, everything would be blown apart. And so it had to be a old style setting. And so I chanced upon 1995 as pretty much the point at which you could just about get away with what I wanted the characters to get away with. So yes, it's got Hitchcockian elements. It's loosely inspired by A Fatal Inversion by Barbara Vine, which, yeah, is obviously her classic book about young people having a hedonistic summer, which ends in tragedy. And then 10 years later, you revisit the characters when two skeletons have been found in the grounds of the house where they spent this summer,
right,
all those years ago. And I actually listened to a dramatization of it on Radio 4 one night when I couldn't sleep. And I just listened to the whole thing all the way through. And in the morning, I got up and thought, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do Secrets Coming Back to Bite You.
Yes.
But, you know, in a really serious way. So that was very much the genesis of the idea for the book. And I had lots of elements, you know, sort of on the back burner that I was thinking about. I knew I wanted to include this Hitchcockian deception that I'm just in love with. And so I knew I wanted to have this Barbara Vine-esque,
right,
group of characters who, you know, everything changes when secrets are revealed. But I also wanted, you know, to sort of have some unusual characters and unusual relationships. I hadn't done a child, a couple struggling with the reality of not being able to have children.
Yes, right,
I hadn't really done that before. And this isn't an IVF book or anything like that. But there is this underlying sorrow to Alex and his wife, Beth, where they live in this family neighborhood. And, you know, it's all about children, but they haven't been able to have them. I also wanted to do an evil pregnant woman, because I feel there are not enough evil pregnant people in fiction. They are always considered saints. And I thought it was time to have an evil pregnant person. And so Zara this flatmate foisted upon Alex in the present day.
Right.
And so there's a lot of exploration of, you know, sort of love triangles, I suppose, and kind of, you know, I'm really interested in these, you know, trios and how people get on as a trio. So you have Alex and Beth in their perfect little cottage in their family neighborhood with this evil pregnant woman who comes in to be their lodger. And then in the past, you have Rick, who's the narrator, and Rollo and Rick's new girlfriend, Marina. And they form an uneasy little party loving triangle as well. And so I really wanted to play with the parallels across the two strands. I think it's really an unusual book, I would say.
It is.
I mean, those who've read A Fatal Inversion will see echoes, but then they're actually not that strong. I think it is quite an unusual read, and I really hope people are going to enjoy it.
It is unusual. It is original. In bearing in mind what we said earlier, but it is an absolutely original read. It takes you down roads I think other authors would have gone a different way, and perhaps a more straightforward and simple way. And it would have been a lesser story for having that, because
that
really grips, you know, really binds you into the story. And talking of that as a complex novel, and we've talked about that a little bit, I'm kind of wondering how much that the complexity of the plot, which you know, I know you have to layer, is also determined by the characters themselves. Because it's very much about these characters and how they react, obviously, in extreme circumstances, the past coming back to bite and things like that. So how much is it sort of the complexity of the plot that you put together or that organically develops, and how much of it is sort of character driven by them and how they behave and react? Do they have that kind of agency?
No, not in my books. Not really. I mean, they have a little bit of agency in that I will start to like one of them a bit better and want to give them a bigger part. So in that sense, I'm more like a director. Mm-hmm. But they are doing my bidding. They are not running away with the plot at all. So. And I've always been that way, that the characters do what is necessary to make the plot credible, really. And then they end up, you know, it ends up being a very organic thing once you get into the psychology of the characters. They could do nothing different from what I planned for them all along, if you see what I mean.
I do.
That's something I have to work at, actually, the psychological plausibility of the characters and their actions.
Yes,
because when you're dealing with domestic noir, to, you know, for want of a better label, it does have to ring psychologically true, because they are basically the sorts of things they do in novels like mine. The reader could very easily say, why didn't they just go to the police at that point?
Right.
Or, you know, why didn't they just say no? Why didn't they, you know, you're always going to bump up against those sorts of questions. And so the characters need to be suitably flawed, or to have something in their history that leads them to behave in this way that, you know, perhaps was ill-advised. Mm-hmm. And quite often I'll have characters have a phobia. I'm a big fan of phobias, because they lead to all kinds of safety behaviors you know, wrong ways of dealing with a situation, because it's all about avoiding something else. So phobias are very good. Certainly in The Only Suspect, a big part of what makes the characters do what they do is just that general sense of recklessness of the era. You know, it was a really hedonistic time, and they are partying nonstop. And so they are drinking a lot, they're doing drugs. There's a very strong link between crime and people being under the influence. So for me, it's not a kind of easy way out, but it feels like a sort of natural explanation of a lot of their behavior is because they're under the influence. In the 1995 strand, you know, if they're not high, they are hungover. You know, everything is just being, everything has a cast of partying about it. And so, you know, it's highly dramatic. You know, relationships feel a lot more dramatic than they would if it was a sober household where everyone sat.
Yes, right.
You know, just watching a, you know, watching a few episodes of, I can't think, they don't even watch TV in The Only Suspect. They're just far too busy partying. But what would they be watching in 95? They might be watching EastEnders or something. Actually, right. they do mention The Big Breakfast. that is one TV show that's mentioned. 1995, was that the year of that big Pride and Prejudice with Colin Firth?
Yes.
And they're not doing that. They're not watching Colin Firth as Darcy.
Something like Our Friends.
Yeah,
in the North,
they're chain smoking and drinking vodka.
And doing what younger people tend to do. Well, certainly that's what we used to do anyway.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
No, that's interesting because you're creating these characters and they are all flawed. That is the point. They all bring, I mean, we are all flawed. That's what people are actually, just to be clear about that, you know, rather than feeling superior about it. But then it's interesting because the novel still has to be character driven. If we can't buy into these characters, no matter how clever you were with the plot, it just wouldn't work. And so is it difficult that, because you mentioned you've got to kind of psychologically profile all these characters and then, you know, get so that their reactions make sense. And I think you are one of the few times I've read a book or books where phobias do matter. It's an interesting way of getting to a character and having an explanation for the way they behave and that. But what I'm trying to ask, I suppose, in a sense, is how easy is it to get to that, get those characters who are unsympathetic characters, but we have to either empathize or understand them when as readers, otherwise it won't work.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'm consciously doing it. I think in terms of, you know, getting people on board with the characters, that's just something
right.
that I have to hope will happen. And I think does in the majority of cases. But I guess that's what the skill of a novelist is. I mean, we're able to imagine characters and gain sympathy for them. And, you know, make them relatable and real enough that even if they are behaving badly or making mistakes or reacting in a way that we, the reader, know we wouldn't do, you can still go with them and recognize it as human behavior. But that's not a conscious thing. That is just what I do, you know, from one day to the next.
Yeah,
I have characters doing things in fiction. And I draw on my own mind all the time in terms of emotional reactions and my own psychology and all my fears and everything I've learned. I draw on all of that. And when I'm writing about younger characters, and they are just, 25 in 1995, I really did actually make a conscious effort to try and remember what I was like at that age. And because you're so naive, you're both super confident because you look so good then and you're having fun and, you know, life is good. And you've got no responsibility,
you're not
no accountability.
About the future and,
You're absolutely not expecting to live beyond 30, say. Yeah. So, you know, you can really just go all in on having a good time. But I did have to remember also, you know, the lack of confidence and, you know, the way I ran relationships was, you know, not very confident and, you know, the different characters that you can fall prey to, you know, all girls, you know, in their 20s will have gone out with a commitment phobe or they will have met a Rollo who, you know, is sort of socially so confident and, you know, comes from that public school background and is really arrogant and manipulative. And, you know, I drew a lot on just real relationships and real emotions that I experienced at the time and my friends did. And so, there was that kind of really digging deep and trying to remember what it's like to be 25, because it really is very different from being 50. You don't know anything. But at the same time, because you do have youth and beauty,
you've got confidence.
Absolutely. Life is easier. So I can't even remember what the question was. But,
well, that's well, you got a perfect answer. If we're looking at the 90s, then did it sort of catch you out a little bit when you look back? You sort of have this, because in your own mind, you've got this picture. Well, you're not a picture, it's your life. It's, you know. Was it interesting to sort of come across things and think, oh, I didn't see it that way, or I don't remember it that way, but actually, you know, these are details that I've come across.
Yeah, it was a really fascinating process because I found it easy to remember the emotions and the experiences and the drama, but I found it harder to remember the, you know, what was actually happening at the time.
Yes.
I think because lifestyle was my concern then. I couldn't remember what was going on politically so well in 1995. I could remember the music and, you know, I couldn't remember. I use my husband, who's a professional researcher. He does my research for me now.
Okay, right.
And so he created a Bible from 1995 for me. Which was really brilliant. And it reminded me of a lot of stuff that I'd completely forgotten, you know, what we wore. Because the other thing was that in those days, you didn't have any photos. I have been able to find photo of myself in 1995. Whereas now you would, you know, now if someone who was 25 would have 1,000 photos of them. They'd know exactly what they wore from one day to the next and what they ate.
In fact,
they listened to.
They take so many photographs. You're never going to see them again. You know, this phone's going to have thousands of photographs in it that nobody ever sees ever again.
It's this natural thing
about taking. And we never took photos.
We had no photos at all. So that meant that I had no documentary evidence of 1995. Mm. So, yeah, so it was really invaluable, this Bible of culture, politics. Andrew, that's my husband. He did me all the number ones throughout the year. I also had the front pages of the Evening Standard, because there is probably not giving too much away to say there is a section in the book where Rick is in hiding, and his only connection with the outside world and how he fits into it through the getting the Evening Standard every afternoon. And so I had all of the headlines. So, you know, I was just reminded that this was a big summer for crime. You know, we had the O.J. Simpson trial going on.
Yeah.
And then we also had the, you know, culturally it was exciting. I don't think Cool Britannia had been coined yet, but we certainly had the Blur Oasis rivalry was at its height in the summer of 95 when they both released their new albums, and it was, you know, a national news story.
All of that stuff.
I had sort of forgotten about, but I was reminded of it. And even, you know, 99% of research doesn't make it into the book, but
sure.
I think it helps me. If I know it, then it just helps me, you know, sort of sound more convincing in
portraying
something.
Like having that sort of soundtrack in your mind as well, knowing about the number ones and things. You're not going to list them in the book, but it does help the sort of process. What about messing with suburbia or screwing a little bit with suburbia and Silvervale? And I was kind of thinking, you know, it's always about ordinary people, isn't it, really? And on the surface, everything's lovely and smooth and calm. People have cars and houses and it all looks nice. And the reality is, and this is what you play with, is this undercurrent of what on earth is really going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm just endlessly fascinated by that. And I always have been, you know, ever since I've been a sort of proper grown up myself, owning a home and starting a family and, you know, sort of going to the school gate and meeting other families that, you know, I would not necessarily have known or been friends with, you know, pre-children. I've just always been really fascinated by particularly the ones who seem so perfect. They seem to have, you know, perfect marriage. They've got the right number of children. Their house is a lovely double fronter. They've just got, you know, ultra confident sort of journey through life. And, you know, I've just really enjoy thinking about what might actually be there under the surface, because it can't possibly be the case that someone has a perfect life. And so in all of my suburban settings, you know, there will be all kinds of drama or deceit or sorrow, I guess, and tragedy going on in the background, because, you know, that is what humanity is. You may be a wise cracking, you know, kind of yummy mummy at the school gate, or you may be, you know, that master of the universe in the office, but the reality is very different. And I think that, again, I mean, the only suspect, I'm wondering if it might sort of end up being the, you know, the peak of all the things I'm interested in. And, you know, maybe I'll move on to something slightly different next. But I do feel like all of the things that I have done before are heightened in this book. And so the very fact that you have this 25-year gap between the source of Alex's guilt and anguish you know, it's a hell of a long time for him to sit on a big secret. And you know, he does say himself in the book that, you know, he now believes it would have been better to have come clean at the time, because he has been a prisoner anyway. So he might as well have been a prisoner in prison, and then he's set free and he at least gets to live the remainder of his life as a free man. But instead, he has condemned himself to a life of, you know, of never really being able to live as he wants to.
I mean, that's one of the interesting things that you have us thinking about in the book, you know, how he has to, in a way, rewrite or hide from himself that kind of truth.
Yeah, absolutely. The nature of guilt.
Some kind of control on it. But of course, it never goes away. Guilt.
No, it doesn't. And he tells us very early on in the book that he's changed his name. So we know that he's gone to the extent of recreating a new identity for himself. And yet, you know, if you saw him walking around Silver Vale, you'd think he was just another contented, complacent husband who's going to have an Aperol spritz in someone's garden. Yeah. You wouldn't know. And that's what I find so fascinating about people generally. I mean, I would hope that, you know, the various, you know, people that I'm watching in my local streets don't have a secret as appalling like as Alex is. Hopefully their mistakes are something that they can, you know, sort of move on from. His is enormous. But yeah, I love that. I love imagining what's actually going on.
Is there sort of an element of, is it satire? A little bit of satire in the way.
Yeah, definitely. It really is, I think. And, you know, over the years with various publishers and editors, I have been, you know, sort of advised to tone down the humour because it's been there right from the start. Mm. Very, very sardonic humour, social commentary, satire. And I think I've, you know, it's taken me a while to find a balance. And one of the ways that I do it is I do it through the characters and the fact that they are quite self-knowing and their humour will be sardonic. Mm. Rather than in the sort of narrative voice, it will come through what the characters say to each other. There's usually a lot of banter between couples. There's usually a lot of, you know, I think of my books as very Gen X. I think all the characters are typical Gen X humour. And, you know, we grew up mocking and being very offensive, and we find it very hard now to be told that you're not allowed to do that.
Absolutely.
And so you know, so that is always being explored in my novels. And you'll see more of that in the future, actually, in my various projects. There's a bit more of the culture wars going on. But in this, in The Only Suspect, there is a lot of satire, and not least with the with Zara, the lodger who outstays her welcome.
Yes.
You know, I think there's a lot of spiky scenes between her and Alex because they have this instant hostility. And, you know, I think it's, again, everything I do is quite instinctive. And I think that I'm just creating a bit of light relief. But it's never going to be, you know, slapstick. It's always going to be about the language and, you know, people being rude and snide and snarking a bit with each other.
Right. I think there was one of the things I thought was really interesting about the novel, and I don't, when you read a novel, it'll end, and it won't end with everything being perfectly resolved. So there's always something that's going to happen afterwards. And as a reader, you tend to think, oh, I wonder what that character did or something like that. I think in your novel, what actually happens is as you're on the way through, you realize that there are so many points where life could be different. Characters could make different decisions that you make that, I think, a thing in the reader's mind where you're thinking, oh, that was a route it could go, but it didn't. It went this way. And you constantly have us rethinking that, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And that's life as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I'm not suggesting that I sit every day weeping with regret about, you know, sort of with the wrong decisions. But I do, I think that, you know, when you do get to your 50s, you do tend to audit your life and your big decisions bit that in a way that you wouldn't have done when you're busy parenting or, you know, just having a laugh when you're younger. And you know, I think that does preoccupy me and it comes out in my work. There are always forks in that road and, you know, inevitably in a in a psychological thriller, they're going to take the wrong turn mm-hmm. rather than the right turn. But there are also some right turns in yes. in my plots. I mean, right. Some people have noticed that quite often criminals will get away with it. And, mm-hmm. you know, you don't necessarily get that you know, hugely satisfying sense of justice. It's more yeah. of a natural yeah. justice than a legal justice in my novels. And quite often the reason that happens is because someone has had a lucky break. Mm. You know, yes, things have gone wrong. Yes, mistakes have been made. But there are also, you know, I love those serendipitous moments in life. Yes. And they can be good as well as bad. And so I want to kind of include them both in my plots. So you'll quite often get, you know, you quite often have a character say, God, I was really lucky that, you know, that happened. And, you know, and I'm very aware of that in life, that, you know, it's, it probably ends up being a decent balance between, you know, mistakes and strokes of luck.
Yeah.
But yeah, you do get both.
Yeah, luck. Yeah, that's very true. It's very important in a novel. And you also need that. You need this randomness. It has to feel like it's an organic process, yeah. doesn't it? However much it may be structured or
yeah, slightly no, changing. Absolutely.
Still talking about the novel, but the audio was done by, I think, Jamie Parker.
Yes, that's right. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's really, I'm sure it's really good to have an actor to do it, isn't it? You know, somebody who really knows what they're doing.
Yeah. Oh my God. I, only last week I got the, you know, the files and, it was so important with this book to have someone who could do both the older and the younger characters.
Right. Yes.
And so I wasn't entirely sure, you know, who that would be and whether it would be better to have the middle-aged actor or to have the younger actor. And, you know, in the end, I think I actually don't know what his age is. I'm guessing he's maybe in his 40s.
He is. He's early 40s, I think.
Early 40s, yeah. I think he's done an amazing job. Yeah, absolutely amazing. I do like my male narrators, and I've been really lucky in the audiobooks. With The Other Passenger, we had Steve McIntosh voice it, and he actually was my inspiration. So I'm a big fan of his. He was my inspiration for the character of Jamie. Whereas I didn't know Jamie Parker well enough to have Alex based on him in reality. But in the case of The Other Passenger, it was, you know, it really was an extraordinary thing to have the very person that I based the character on voicing the audiobook. But yeah, they both do a fantastic job. And, you know, again, as I, you know, talking about that sardonic humor of the sort of Gen X characters, and they both really bring that the characters. Yeah. And so they make them so distinctively of a time and of a generation, which I really like.
Yeah. Because you did a little bit of that for yourself, didn't you? You were the journalist in The Heights. Isn't it? Yes, right.
I was. Yeah, I think I mentioned that I'd written a quick read, which was called The Skylight.
Yes, you did.
And that's a charitable endeavour with the reading agency.
I'm glad you mentioned that, literacy. Actually, because I think those are important. Those
they're so important, and they're brilliant books as well.
Yes.
But they obviously have a very limited budget because, you know, they're not profit making endeavours at all. And so I had done the audiobook myself for that. You know, just to help out. And I enjoyed it far more than I thought I would. I thought I would, you know, hate it and get really tired and, you know, lose concentration. But in fact, it was just really absorbing and I really learned a lot and I really enjoyed it. So I said to my publisher, oh, you know, I'll happily, you know, do one of these little parts in The Heights, because The Heights was multi narrators. And so they let me be the sarcastic journalist.
They felt that fitted.
Yeah, they felt that would be better for me than taking on the very huge role of Ellen, the neurotic mum. So yeah, I really enjoyed that. But it's hard. I mean, it's much harder than you think. And
I think I'd probably race through it. You know, you get that temptation to start and want to get to the end.
But this is that's exactly it. Nail on the head.
Right.
The amateurs like me are obviously much faster than the professionals. Mm.
Yeah, you have to learn to relax into it. And just a quick word for the television. I mean, this is so brilliant. Obviously, Our House was on ITV and it's still on ITVX now, of course.
Yes, yeah.
But you have now two more shows in production. at least, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, well, there's lots in development, so they're not actually in production yet.
Tell us a little bit about
so at this moment in time, nothing else has been greenlit. But yes, the same team for that did Our House are working on The Only Suspect. Mm-hmm. So the same screenwriter, Simon Ashdown, just starting to pick apart Alex and Rick's story, see what he can do with it. Mm-hmm. And that's the same production company, Red Planet. And then, The Heights has a pilot that has literally just come through and is absolutely brilliant.
Right.
And The Other Passenger has a pilot that actually was written by an American screenwriter and has been sort of anglicized. So we've got two versions of that. And then there are a few more. The Swimming Pool and Lifesaver are also under option. And, we've got treatments for those.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it'd be really interesting to see which one, if any,
Are you happy that somebody else takes up the project, like Simon Ashdown and writes the script? You want it in expert hands, I suppose, but you're happy with that,
are you? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I have started doing some screenwriting myself, but, I'm, a beginner. Mm. And someone like Simon is, I've been so lucky with the screenwriters who've worked on my project so far. What he did with Our House, I thought was genius, because it was an extremely complicated book. And to be able to sort of strip it down the way he did and
get the essence
reconstruct
of it.
Yeah, because, there are twists and reveals in that book that, only work on the page. They simply can't work on screen when you can see everything. He was able to sort of get the maximum drama. We've already had a little chat about how things will work with The Only Suspects.
Right.
There are a few things that need to be addressed. Mm. And again, it just always makes me really value writing novels, because you can just get away with so much on the page, just that, by manipulating the reader's imagination. And you just absolutely can't do that in the same way on screen. You can't disguise things in the same way. I've learned a lot from reading Simon's work and the other screenwriters I'm working with. And it's been really useful for writing novels and also for learning a new type of writing myself.
Well, all of this really must be taking up a phenomenal amount of your time. Are you working on a new novel at the moment?
I am, yes. I do have to ring fence time to, write, because there are so many projects going on. And then, of course, there's usually a book to publicise as well, and which takes up a bit of time. I've just become quite well organized. I'm an empty nester now. My daughter's at university. So I noticed that freed up.
Mm.
It wasn't so much the physical time as the sort of mental, emotional time, sort of not worrying, freed up a lot of time. So I'm kind of going through a good purple patch of enjoying working hard and also being quite well organized, because I definitely used to be a bit more chaotic when I think about what I used to achieve in a year compared to now. And yet I'm probably spending the same number of hours at the laptop. I'm not quite sure what I was doing. I suppose I was polishing those phrases,
those lines,
and making everything
phrases,
sound beautiful.
Yeah.
Whereas now I'm not doing that so much.
The thing
much.
Now is just to avoid the social media a little bit as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can wind up going down a rabbit hole with that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd really like to avoid social media, but that is a requirement for an author.
Of course, it is. In the modern age, you absolutely can't.
This is the one thing that I found that, luckily I'm a bit older and I do have the confidence to sort of resist sometimes, but there is always something more that an author can do. Mm. There's always a new job that an author can take on in marketing and promoting their own work.
So
you literally could spend your whole time trying to promote your work. So you do at some point have to say, look, what I actually bring to the table is writing the stories, storytelling, creating these new stories that can be sold. I can't actually do other bits as well, unless it erodes the time I have writing. I think that I used to spend probably about 95% of my time, work time, writing. And now I'm really lucky if that's 50%. So that's right. That's the difference.
Shows you though, doesn't
20
it?
Years.
Yeah. One last question then. How about a recommendation? Something, a book, it could be a film, I don't mind. It's you know, something that you recommend.
Oh my goodness. So I'm trying to think what I've recently read. I'm currently reading, actually it hasn't come out yet. So I know it's always frustrating when people say books that haven't come out yet. I'm reading The Honeymoon by oh my gosh, what's her name? Kate Gray. It's under my laptop. So I've got a pile of books on my laptop. Kate Gray, it's her first psychological thriller. And it's got a really good hook. It's about two couples who meet on honeymoon in Bali, and one of the couples witnesses a death. And then the two couples go back to their lives in Britain, and they start to, the relationships start to disintegrate, I think it's fair to say, but I won't give anything more away than that.
Right.
But I'm really enjoying that. And what else have I read recently? Maybe Next Time, which is not a crime novel by Cheska Major. It's a Groundhog Day book about a literary agent. So I really enjoyed that. And then my crime has been mainly on TV. I've just watched, you'll find this hilarious, but I've only just watched 10 Years Late, Broadchurch.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Which I really enjoyed.
This is the English one.
The English one, yeah. Oh my God, what other ones are there?
Right, watch Broadchurch, enjoy it, and then if you get a chance, see the American one, which is also with David Tennant, and is terrible.
Oh really?
So
oh my God!
It's not his fault. It's just that they don't get it, and sometimes they don't get Nordic noir when they do it either.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting.
Work.
Is it the same story then?
Well, with twists and turns, you know, they've tinkered with it, let's say, but I honestly it's not very good.
No, I certainly couldn't watch it all, and I think it's called Grace Point, really.
Oh really?
Anyway,
that's so interesting.
You're watching the good one. That's
I'm
the
watching
important.
Yeah,
you're watching the one that's well worth watching.
I am.
He is a mesmeric actor.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good, and I really love the setting. I really love the you know, the all of the incredible shots of the coast and all of the various coastal properties. But I've also just finished White Lotus 2, which is another one where it's, you know, the setting is, you know, a character in its own right.
Just getting that, yes.
Which I love. Yeah. So that's my latest consumption.
Well, I'll make sure that those are on the program notes so people can see that anyway.
Yeah. Oh, Louise, brilliant.
That's been brilliant. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed chatting.
So a big thank you to Louise Candlish for a really fascinating chat there. I really enjoyed that, and I hope you did too. If you're interested in buying The Only Suspect, which is available now, you can get it in hardback from Simon & Schuster at all good book outlets. And if you want to, you can get it from us by clicking the link on the program page, which will take you to bookshop.org. If you've enjoyed the show, please rate and subscribe with your favorite podcast provider. I'll be back with another interview very shortly. In fact, it's Simon Mason talking about his novel, The Broken Afternoon. And really, that's one you won't want to miss, I promise you. Just one small note before I do go. I'm really thrilled to announce that Crime Time FM, and me in particular, we'll be going to the Gwilcrime Cymru Festival in Aberystwyth, which I think is April the 21st to the 23rd, as the official podcast of the event. There'll be more news on that shortly. For now, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.